We were talking about the Kate Smith Hour. One final question about Kate Smith. Was she comfortable in television, in the medium? Was that?
I think she liked the response that she got. And I remember somebody saying to me that she made $35,000 a week. And in 1951, well, it's an enormous salary anytime, but in 1951, can you imagine? All I know is that I was constantly astounded by her voice. And it was an absolutely natural organ. I mean, that instrument was so pure. It was a glorious voice. Now, I don't know whether she was comfortable in the medium or not. She sure knew where to go and what to do.
And then you went, another show you worked on was the Gabby Hayes Show.
Gabby Hayes, yes.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about that, about that experience.
Well, I've often said that he was the person who... I said to him one time, "Mr. Hayes, what do you think of when you look at that camera and know that there are thousands of people watching you?" And he said, "Freddie, I think of one little buckaroo." And, you know, that must have gone straight to my heart, because when I look at the camera, I think of one person. Not any specific person, but one person. It's very, very personal, this medium. Well, if you have that's one of the reasons I thought that for education it would be so fabulous. Because if you have someone on television in a classroom, it looks like that person is looking at each student individually. A live teacher can't do that. A live teacher can do other things, though. You know, you'll never find me saying that any machine is better than a person. In fact, that is underlined constantly in the neighborhood. For the first time, I showed a computer on a tape that we did the other day for the neighborhood. And I was insistent that I would say there are lots of fun things that go on here, you know, but no machine can take the place of a person. This machine cannot give you a hug. It might be able to spell H-U-G, but it can't give you one. And, well, that's obvious. But you know, it might not be obvious to children. And so consequently, I think it's important to let them know how I feel.
How do you feel about you know, some shows today, like the Teletubbies, that sort of embraces machinery and...
I don't know the program, but when I was told that there was a character with a television in its stomach, I was horrified. Anything that makes people think that machines are more important than people. Although I have a feeling that is not the purpose of that program. I don't think the purpose of that program is to say that machines are more important than people. I don't know, but I think it would be interesting to find out for you.
Okay, and then back to Gabby Hayes. Can you describe what the show was?
Did I what?
Can you describe the Gabby Hayes show?
Oh, Gabby Hayes would come in his Western clothes and show old Western films. And he would just introduce them and then at the end say, see you buckaroos or something, you know. What fascinated me was that, you know, he had his accent, and but when the program was over, he'd go to the dressing room on the nights that he had his tickets. He'd get into his formal clothes and go to the opera. He had a box at the opera. He loved the opera. Often you don't know the depth of someone that you see only on television, because that person who, like he was, playing a part, and here he is, having a great love of classical music.
What other shows did you work on in NBC?
The Hit Parade, the Voice of Firestone, Gabby Hayes, Kate Smith. I mean, Kate Smith was every day, every afternoon, at the Hudson Theater. NBC owned the Hudson Theater. I don't know whether it's still there or not. I think those are the only ones. The NBC Opera Theater became the most important one for me, because when I became the head floor manager of that, then I was on in all of the production meetings. And the best part of that was hearing those operas over and over again. The ones that I floor managed, I mean, I know practically Billy Budd, for instance. I still sing parts of Billy Budd, King of the Sea. This was a Benjamin Britten opera. But you'll hear all that from Kirk. Yeah. You can cross-reference.
let's talk about some of the people at NBC who you may have encountered. Did you ever meet David Sarnoff?
I did not meet him. My great uncle knew him quite well. And so whenever my great uncle would come to New York, he would stop in and see me, and then he would go and visit with Sarnoff. I'd like to have met Sarnoff, because is it apocryphal, this story, that he received one of the messages from the Titanic? Is that apocryphal?
It's debated.
It's debated.
Yes. Yes.
He said
that he did that.
Oh, he said he did it.
Yeah.
I said. Well, there'd been so much talk lately about the Titanic, you know, that I thought, isn't that interesting? This young teletype operator might have received one of the messages. And also, I think he had a tie with Nantucket, which is where we go every summer.
But also the music.
But Sarnoff, I mean, that was a business for him, you know. But he took it, I think he took it seriously, that broadcasting could enhance the public in way. I mean, those operas, somebody sitting out in Kansas who had never been to New York, for instance, to see A Mall in the Night Visitors, or Trouble in Tahiti, or Pique Dame, or any of the ones that we produced, talk about enhancing culture. Television has such a great chance to do that, and to teach foreign languages. You know, we have a character in the neighborhood, a new character that we've just introduced, called the Hula Mouse, the Royal Hula Mouse, and he lives in the castle with King Friday, and he speaks only Spanish. Well, the scripts are written in a way that the English that goes before and the English that comes after each one of his speeches, the Spanish is understood. I guess, you know, here we go back to Dartmouth and my love for Romance languages, and we have so many people writing to us saying, I came from Italy, I came from Israel, I came from many different countries, and you helped me to learn English. You know, they would find someone who spoke slowly and deliberately on the air, and invariably, if I'm going to talk about a cup, I'll have one in my hand, you know, and say cup, and the water's in it, you know. I didn't mean to do that, but I think it's a wonderful dividend of people from other nationalities learning our language through the neighborhood.
Now that you're aware of it, did you change anything in the way you...
That's a wonderful question. I'm sure it crosses my mind at times. But I realize I'm not there to teach English. I'm there just to be myself. And so just continue being yourself, Fred.
Okay, we were talking about some people you may have encountered. Did you ever meet Pat Weaver, NBC president, during the time you were there?
I think I met him the first day because I had a letter of recommendation to him, and I think he hired me. Now maybe he, you know, I worked on those color test programs. That's the other thing that I worked on.
It's coming up.
Yeah. I was the first floor manager in 3K, which had the only color cameras in New York. There were three color sets that could receive these programs. General Sarnoff had one, and Niles Trammell had the second, and I think maybe it was Pat Weaver who had the third. There were just three sets. And all we did in this studio was to move things from one place to another so that the cameras could take pictures of them. And I remember my first day on the job, somebody said, move the green parrot to the left. And I said, which one is the green one? I'm colorblind. And to have the first floor manager for color television to be colorblind, I think is a kind of whimsical thing. And so it didn't make all that much difference. You know, they just wanted to see pictures in their home of this new thing called color television.
Describe what they saw. What was the
just
setup?
Just animals and photographs. And yeah, there was no production. It was just things that we would bring in and put on camera. And if they happened to be turning on their sets at home, why, they'd just see something colorful. Parrots were colorful.
How long did you do that? Have it set up?
Oh, I think I may have been on that detail a couple weeks. But that was Studio 3K. I don't know whether they even have it there now.
Were the tests successful?
The tests were fine, yes. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was the, you know, it was the RCA color that was chosen. There were competing ones, and it was chosen to be the one that would go throughout the country.
Now, you've been in television a few years at this point, probably. What was your opinion of it now that you were in it? What were some of your impressions looking now at the outside?
You mean now?
No, when you were there, your first encounter with television was negative, and now, 2 or 3 years into it, you're in it.
I liked some of those programs. You know, I was impressed with the musical programs that we did. There were still some that were. I guess there'll always be pie-throwing programs, but they don't need to be in the majority. I thought television was doing good things. However, I didn't feel that I could use all the talents that had been given to me as a floor manager. Nevertheless, I think the floor manager position is an exceedingly important one. I mean, for instance, Gabby Hayes again said to me one day, "Do you realize that you're the only face that I see? Even though when I look in the camera, I'm thinking of one person. The person that I'm closest to is you." He said, "It makes such a difference if the floor manager seems interested in what you're doing. It's awful to have a floor manager who's, you know." So that's a real art.
Did anyone else you ever work with say something like that to you? Was that a common thing?
Oh, well, you know, there are a lot of people in the operas, but they were so concentrated on what... It's very different when something is a dramatic thing than when it is... when you're looking at the camera and you're feeling whether the people around you are enthusiastic about what you're doing. That makes a big difference. I have the most wonderful floor manager in the world, Nicky Tallow. You know, he has an advanced sense of humor. He and Jimmy Seach, and, well, Michael Douglas was here for quite a long time with us. He went to Hollywood and became Michael Keaton. And those three on the set, we just had a ball. They were always playing jokes on me. One time they put shoes that were so small for me, I couldn't, at the end of the program, I couldn't get my feet in them. No, that's not true. They weren't small shoes. They were my shoes, but they had put paper at the toe. And I kept putting them in, singing the last song, you know, "Such a good feeling to know you're alive," trying to put that. But that was just for the rehearsal. And one time, you know, picture on our set, Michael was always behind there. And there's that little thing that I slide over and put in the videotape for picture. Well, one day in rehearsal, I slid this thing open and I heard this voice say, "I'm ready to hear your confession, son." That was Michael.
Did you ever do anything like that on the sets of the shows you worked on?
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think I was that brave.
Okay, before we start talking about your work in public television, do you have any final thoughts about your work at NBC that you'd like to tell us?
It was such a great learning place for me. But some of the greatest things about it were the people that I worked with. And isn't that always the case? I mean, you can learn the mechanics anywhere, but it's the relationships that develop. I mean, Kirk Browning, for instance, was one of the ushers in our wedding. And when people work very close together to create something that they feel has value, that they want to give to their audiences, they become a community. And it's a real blessing to be part of a community of givers. I mean, if your main focus happens to be the person who is going to be watching what you're producing, that to me is the greatest thing that you could ever have. And when people, I mean, it's so much more important than how many people are going to be watching. It's what if this person who is watching is somehow moved to do something of value because of what you've put on the air. That's so much more important than that numbers the millions of people who are tuned in. But it's all a matter of quality versus quantity. And if we can only not fall for the numbers game, we can continue to have this medium be a really thoughtful one.
Do you remember any cases at NBC that affected you as far as advertisers and ratings and all that kind of thing?
No, I don't. Those are fairly hazy days. So much happened between those days at NBC and when I came here to Pittsburgh that was a phenomenal bridge. I mean, when I heard that educational television, which is now called public television, when educational television was going to be starting in Pittsburgh, I mean, only 40 miles from where I grew up, I told some of my friends at NBC that I thought that I'd put my name in and apply for the station. They said, "You are nuts. That place isn't even on the air yet. And you're in line to be a producer or a director or anything you want to be here." And I said, "No, I have the feeling that that educational television might be, at least for me, the way of the future."
What year was that?
That was in 1953. And I applied and was one of the first, I think one of the first six to be hired at WQED, which, true, it wasn't on the air yet. We didn't go on the air until April 1st of 1954. But this was in 1953, and Joanne and I moved to Pittsburgh in November of 1953, and that's when I started at WQED.
Before we talk about that, what was the state of educational television at that time?
WQED was the first community-sponsored television station in the country. There were a few others that were linked with universities, but this was the very first that a whole community decided to underwrite. So Pittsburgh was at the forefront of community broadcasting.
And who hired you at QED?
Her name, she was the general manager, and her name was Dorothy Daniel. And we named Daniel Tiger for her. In fact, the night before we went on the air, I've got to tell you about that. The first night on the air was a special program, and that was April 1st, 1954. People had been watching the test pattern for weeks before that, but this was to be an hour special. We invited Frieda Hennig, who was the commissioner on the FCC, to come and be part of the program. Because without Frieda Hennig, there would have been no educational television. There would have been no PBS. There would have been no channels set aside for education throughout the country. She was adamant about there should be one free channel in every area. And it's thanks to Frieda Hennig that PBS and educational television exist. At any rate, Frieda Hennig came, and a very enthusiastic person. Talk about a good teacher. She was enthusiastic about what she had championed, and well, she might have been. We got on the air and showed little parts of what was to come. And we, Josie and I, showed a part of the children's corner, and somebody else showed a part of, I think that we had a music program from Carnegie Tech, but lots of different excerpts. In other words, this is what you're going to see next week. Well, near the end of the program, Mrs. Daniels said, and now we have Frieda Hennig, a commissioner from the FCC, here to help us tonight. Frieda Hennig came on, started to talk about the vision of educational television, her passion. She went on and on and on, and finally, after she had talked, I think 40 minutes, Mrs. Daniel came in, you know, with the proverbial hook, and said, it's just been wonderful having you here, Frieda Hennig, and we thank you for all your help. But you see, here's somebody who really cared just enormously about what educational television could mean in this country. And I just love to think about that. At any rate, before we went on the air on April 5th, you see, April 1st was a Thursday, and then we went dark until Monday when regular programming would begin, and that was April 5th. Well, on the 4th, Mrs. Daniel gave us a party, all the people who were going to be on the air. And she gave favors at the party. And my favor was a little tiger puppet. And I said to Josie, our hostess, I said, why don't we just make a slit in the set, and I can poke this puppet through. Let's call it Daniel. And we'll just use it once. But what we did, the art department had painted this fanciful set, and there happened to be a clock on it. So I just put the little slit in the clock and poked Daniel and said, hello, Josie, it's 5:03, and Columbus discovered America in 1492, and went like that and pulled him away.